this morning to sort of clear the air and recapitulate some of the things we have said about Ecclesiastes so that we can get those fundamental truths down and move to some other lessons in the book. I had said that Ecclesiastes is an expression of what Paul said in Romans 8 verse 20, that the world had been subjected to vanity in hope. Now, it is not explicitly stated who did that in Romans, but it is implicitly God who is in view. God subjected the world to vanity. And when he said that in the third chapter of Genesis and verse 19, that dust you are and to dust you shall return, he unleashed in the world what Paul was referring to in Romans 8:20, futility and vanity. But it was done in hope, the apostle said. And I believe we can see that hope shining in Ecclesiastes, though it is many centuries before the time when the gospel of Jesus was preached in the world. But life under the sun, as it was in Solomon's day, still projects an appearance of vanity and futility. And if all you have to examine it with and understand it with is that unaided wisdom of man, and what you can see here and experience here with your five senses, then I think it will not only give a sense of futility, but of ultimate and profound futility and despair. But I don't believe that Solomon was ever despairing. He was never just writing down his thoughts at the moment and wrestling with that for a while, and then he'd go to the next problem and wrestle with that for a while, and go to the next problem and wrestle with that for a while. And then finally, when he got to the conclusion of the book, he decides, well, no, this is the answer. That's not the case. He knows the answer before he starts. And he speaks it before he starts. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. And that's exactly what he says when he gets to the conclusion. Those statements bracket the book. But it was done with hope by God. Let's go back and talk about life under the sun as it is seen by Solomon, that there were crooked things that could not be straightened and the things missing could not be numbered. Chapter 1, verse 15. And he said, our wisdom, his wisdom, as great as it was, and he was greater than any other man's, was not able to penetrate the purposes of God and to understand why certain things happen. It's always interesting to me when people rail against God and say there could not be a good God and have a world like this. And they never stop to think that they wouldn't be judging this world and its injustices and painful inequities unless there was a God who had put it in their hearts to see those painful inequities and injustices. Where did we get this ability and inclination to judge life as being unjust? But from the God who made us. And so sometimes our arguments against God turn out to be arguments for him. But our wisdom cannot penetrate these things. Jeremiah 10:23, the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walks to direct his own steps. Simple truth, absolutely correct. But Solomon tried by his wisdom to understand these things, and as we noted yesterday, utterly and absolutely failed. Chapter 1, verse 18, for as much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And then at chapter 3, and verse 11, he made everything beautiful in his time. And also he has set eternity in their hearts, yet so that man cannot find out the work that God has done from the beginning even to the end. The mind of man cannot penetrate the mind of God, cannot know his everlasting purposes, and cannot reconcile, even when he finds out what those purposes are, cannot reconcile those purposes with what's happening down here in our lives. In the apparent meaninglessness of life under the sun, the endless turnings of the cycles of nature which seem to be going nowhere, and in the jarring contradictions in human life under the sun, chapter 3, we see no evidence of the righteous purposes of God. Injustice, we mentioned already, chapter 3, verse 16. And moreover, I saw under the sun in the place of justice that wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness that wickedness was there. In chapter 4, 1 to 3, then I returned and saw all the oppressions that were done under the sun. And behold, the tears of such as were oppressed, and they had no comforter. And on the side of their oppressors was power, but they had no comforter. That is still true. And he goes on in chapter 7. Excuse me, in verse 15. All this have I seen in my days of vanity. There is a righteous man that perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man that prolongs his life in his evil doing. The righteous die young. Remember, Stephen? And the wicked live a long time. That's not absolutely true, but it's true. And we can see cases of it in our own experience in life. In chapter 8 and verse 14. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth, that there are righteous men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked again, and there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. And that also still is true. And even if the light of the gospel shines on you, and you learn by revelation, which is the only way you can learn this, that God has an eternal purpose for men and that it's gracious and good, still you will not understand this. You will not be able to work out in your mind just exactly why this happens in this way. I've been confronted with countless puzzles of the most godly people, as far as I can tell, who don't need any more chastening, who've been chastened and chastened and chastened and are pure, but their lives are hounded by all kinds of distresses and tragedies, while some others who look to me like they need all kinds of spanking are just not getting anything, apparently, and going on. It's something that's held in the mind of God and not for us to know. And there's something else that I had not mentioned in the 9th chapter in verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happens to them all. This is the world of vanity, created by our sin, rebellion against God, of which Paul speaks, and which is recorded in Genesis 3. A world in which time and chance has been unleashed by God. Sometimes we think everything must have some sort of designated purpose on God's part, that He has initiated it, and He brings this suffering or this sorrow or this tragedy. And the truth is that ever since dust was returning to dust, and disease came into the world, and add to that our own iniquitous ways and the way we treat each other and the consequences that come to that, this has been true. And time and chance come. And many times tragedy is just time and chance. I want you to know, though, that Solomon would not accept the premise that time and chance rule absolutely. Because if that were the case, the providence of God would be nullified. His care for His people would be nullified. The problem is, you see, that we have to trust God to take all these things, and as our brother has been speaking of, this great three-verse section of Romans 8:28, that God works all things. All things. I've read some students of these passages who want to say, but that's just the things particularly mentioned here. It's not everything. Well, I will admit that He doesn't work your own transgressions and iniquity together for good, but so far as the things that happen to you are concerned, the iniquity and wickedness of others, tragedies, anything you can imagine that cuts you to the heart, all those things God can use to bless you. And I think that's exactly the case. But time and chance do happen. You know, you look at people, this man that just seems to be so able to achieve his purposes, and the race just doesn't go to the swift. It may be some person who's less likely to succeed than ever you could imagine who at last wins the prize. But we cannot depend on our skill and our ingenuity and our wisdom to achieve anything. It can be cut off instantaneously. And that point has been made, especially with regard to health and wealth. Secondly, we can find nothing beneath the sun that's ultimately valuable and ultimately satisfying. Solomon tried that. He tried to find something down here that would satisfy his soul and preserve him everlastingly. And there wasn't anything, not pleasure. He said it was madness, chapter 2, verses 1 to 3. But some of us have decided that we can have an everlasting party, and somehow or another that's just going to satisfy. We keep having one party after another. But Solomon said in chapter 7 and verse 6 that the laughter of fools is like the crackling of thorns under the pot. It's hollow. And you hear people who say they're having a great time and they're laughing the place up and going from one great party to the next party, and it's all hollow. They're chasing after something, but it's obvious they're not finding it. There's no peace, no satisfaction. California is not the only place where people party all the time. It's a national pastime. But I think it's whistling through the graveyard. An effort to escape from the realities that are pressing upon these people. And if you've ever been disposed to envy them, I think you need to take another look. Solomon had all the opportunities to take his pleasures, and it was absolutely empty. Vanity of vanities, he said. And it's not things. Although in a society of great wealth, we identify our own personal identity. We identify ourselves with what we possess. That's what we call covetousness. That's what Jesus called covetousness. He said, a man's life does not consist in the abundance of things which he possesses. And it's not great enterprises, building, doing great things. That won't satisfy either. Solomon declared those things just as empty as his attempt to find satisfaction and peace and fulfillment and pleasure. And that's true because they are fragile, easily lost. And he speaks about people get that wealth and it's gone by evil adventure. As quickly as we had it, it's gone. And we made all our plans, and we took out insurance, and we made every provision. But I want to tell you something. Life is pretty capricious. I can remember when men in this country thought if they could attach themselves to certain industries, that they were just as solid as a rock, and if they got a job there, they'd have a job there as long as they lived, and their retirement would be secure. And we found out that's not true. And we've never lived in a time, even in our prosperity now, when a job is so fragile. And as soon as you get it, you know you could lose it because the economy can shift in this global kind of economic situation. And suddenly there's no demand here and that company goes south and you've got to run and chase and find it up. You don't find security. It's made me feel rather good about preaching, actually. I feel more secure in some ways than others. Look, I'm not secure in those things either, of course. But I used to think preaching was a rather dangerous business. You know, you could just get sent on your way like that. And then I see everybody else being sent on their way. And I say to myself, well, maybe none of us really got that security, which is the absolute truth. And we are fragile. We can't take it with us. Chapter 5, verse 15. You brought nothing in the world. Not going to take anything out. That's obvious. That's obvious. You can't build on that. It's building on the sand. And even while we live, we lose the power to enjoy what we've got. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Man, God gives a man riches, and then he doesn't have the power to enjoy it. And then he says in chapter 5, verse 12, that, well, let's just read that. That seemed to me a significant kind of statement. The sleep of a laboring man is sweet, whether he eat little or much. But the fullness of the rich will not suffer him to sleep. He's worried about holding on to it. Concerned about maintaining it, and therefore can't even sleep, gets no rest. Then finally, the point that's made by Solomon is they never satisfy. If you had all that you could get, the whole world, and if you could have it forever, let's just say you could have all these things and have them forever. Chapter 5, verse 10. He that loves silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that loves abundance with increase. It will never satisfy. You can't pour that trash, and that's about what it is compared to reality. You can't pour that trash into the emptiness of your soul and expect to be satisfied. Oh, you've heard all that's been said about John D. Rockefeller when they asked him how much money it took to satisfy, and he said just a little more. And Schopenhauer said that this love of money was like drinking seawater. The more you drank, the thirstier you got. Or as I think one poet said, water everywhere and not a drop to drink. That is to say, nothing to satisfy. Your eternal spirit will never be satisfied. You've got to understand you are something special. made in the image of God. And there is no way under God's heaven you'll ever be satisfied with these tawdry things. They're not evil in themselves, these things, but as a foundation for life, they are sand. And we've got somehow to divest ourselves of this madness of covetousness that causes us to think if you haven't got something, you're not anybody, and if you've got something, you really are somebody. So that if we lost all of it, the question we need to ask ourselves, if we lost a lot of it, will we be left? Or would our lives be gone, shattered? Why has God put us in such a world as this? That's the question we are compelled to face in this book. Paul said in Romans 8:20 that he subjected the world to vanity in hope. In hope of what? In hope that somehow the tragedy of our transgressions visited upon us since Adam and Eve should awaken us to the fact that things are not right down here. This is no paradise. Let me tell you, this is no paradise. In the dawn of life, maybe you can think it so. But as life progresses, it will become exceedingly clear to you that it is not. Chapter 3 in Ecclesiastes, verse 14, says that God caused all those jarring contradictions that are listed there in that poem, in which he says there's a time to kill, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal. He's just saying all those seasons are going to be visited upon you. It's not something you choose. This is not something you have to wrestle with and decide, is this the time? This is going to be visited upon you, and God has done it. Why? Verse 14, I know that whatsoever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be put to it nor anything taken from it. And God has done it that men should fear before him. The hope of God is that we will at last look up and get our eyes off this and see him in his grace and his goodness and his greatness and his power, and recognize that the answer for us is not even in understanding things, but in trusting him and in reverencing him and in worshiping him. Chapter 3, verse 18. A challenging passage. I said in my heart, it is because of the sons of men that God may prove them, that they may see that they themselves are but as beasts. For that which befalls the sons of men befalls beasts. Even one thing befalls them, as one dies, so dies the other. Yes, they have all one breath, and man hath no preeminence above the beast, for all is vanity. And insofar as things under the sun are concerned, I can tell you, as you observe, you die, a dog dies, there's no difference. You have the same physical breath. You're made of clay too. And why does God arrange it this way? That's what he said, you are dust and to dust you shall return. Why does he do that? Solomon says it's so that we'll understand our frailty, recognize our dependence, and quit elevating ourselves above that which we may be. Of course he knows that the spirit of a man goes up, and says it in chapter 12, verse 7, in case anybody thinks, it's incredible to me, somebody think Solomon, forget what he wrote over here in the third chapter. When he gets to the 12th chapter, he says there that the body returns the dust whence it came, and the spirit returns where? To God who gave it. He understands that. He's just telling you, if you're looking for something under the sun, this is how it is. And God has brought us to this frail condition when we are subject at any time. I'm telling you, we are fragile creatures. One small microbe overnight and we are dead. And we think we are running around because I know how to drive and I can take care of everything, and yet one sudden co-location event over which you have absolutely no control. As those four godly individuals driving peacefully down the highway stopped behind an 18-wheeler, and suddenly some fella, unobserving or whatever the case may be, strikes them from the rear, and when that accident is over, that van was 4 feet long and their lives are gone. You think you can control that? You think you've just been a good driver and you've been watching and you've been taking your vitamins and therefore everything is going to be all right? I'm telling you. We will die, and sometimes suddenly, and not with a long illness in which we will have the opportunity to prepare ourselves for the death that's coming. We don't know about that. And God has done it so that we will look up
and worship Him.
Colossians 2 verse 3 says that in Him that is in Christ are all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge hidden. And Solomon knew this before. Proverbs 1, 7 and 9, 10. That the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge and the beginning of wisdom. That's the foundation. We begin to learn when we start reverencing God. And that doesn't mean we'll know everything immediately. But I'll tell you what it does mean we will know. We will know His great redemptive purpose in Christ. And that helps, I'm telling you. Romans 8, 31. What shall we say to these things? If God be for us, who shall be against us? I can't work out the details of what's happening here. But I'm telling you, I know who is in charge of it. And He has demonstrated that He cares about people. And isn't that what Romans 8:32 is about? He that spared not His own Son, but delivered Him up for us all. How shall He not also freely give us all things? So, it's not getting the answers to why A, B, C, and D happen. It's getting to know God and trusting Him and His care for us. And so He works all things together for good, and we who love Him and called according to His purposes have that confidence. So what is the answer here? Well, chapter 7, verse 18. It is good that you should take hold of this. Yes, also from that withdraw not your hand. For he that fears God shall come forth from them all. He didn't just reach that conclusion in the 12th chapter. He's telling us already that's the way it is. Don't you worry about these circumstances. Don't be defeated by what's happening to you. Don't let them crush your spirit. God knows, and God cares, and God is able to do something about it, and He will. But we have to trust Him. Chapter 8 and verse 12. Though a sinner do evil 100 times, and yet prolong his days, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God. Now you must work that in to all that Solomon says. Because if you don't do that, you will misunderstand some of his statements. And twisting them as a consequence of failing to recognize the context, you will make a bad application, and it may have a bad consequence to you and to other people. Well, the question is now, what shall we do in this uncertain life where the race is not to the swift nor bread to the wise, and where time and chance happen to all? Shall we just crawl in a cave somewhere and hide away and wait for the inevitable? Solomon says otherwise. And these things that are no good as a foundation for life and as the real meaning of life, what should we do with them and what should our response be to them? Chapter 2, verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than that he should eat and drink and make his soul enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw that it is from the hand of God. But people read this and say, that's a contradiction. He just said it's all vanity. He just announced that he'd done all these great works and it was miserable as a God. Well, it is if you try to make that what life is about. If that's all you've got, you will be wretched. But if you know that it's by God's hand that all things will be worked out and you fear and trust and reverence Him, let me tell you something. You can enjoy what God gives you. And remember, it is His gift. And remember, it's with regard to Him that you receive it. What a difference that is than trying to make this what life is all about and pushing God out of the picture. And he goes on, chapter 3 and verse 12, he repeats the theme. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good so long as they live, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy good in all his labor is the gift of God. Chapter 3, verse 22, wherefore I saw that there is nothing better than that a man should rejoice in his works, for that is his portion. For who shall bring him back to see what shall be after him? You don't know what the future holds. And a lot of people, because they don't know what the future holds, they are so scared to death that they're not enjoying the present either. Anxiety totally dominates them. And Solomon says, don't do that. Let God take care of that. And you enjoy the gifts that He's given you as they're here. They may not be here tomorrow, but while they're here, rejoice and be grateful and receive those gifts gladly. 5:18. Behold, that which I have seen to be good and to be comely is for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy good in all his labor, when he labors under the sun, all the days of his life which God has given him, for this is his portion. I believe with all my heart that people who have learned to trust God, and they know what's everlasting and they know what's important, they're the only ones who will ever be able to enjoy this earth and take these gifts, bow their heads with gratitude that they have them. And I think we're the only ones who could eat our food with gladness and singleness of heart. Because for us, it is a taste of heaven's gift, of God's goodness and his care. And we receive it knowing that he will always care for us. Chapter 8 and verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be joyful. But that shall abide with him in his labor and all the days of his life which God has given him under the sun. But here he said, all this mirth, that is vanity. And the sound of fool's laughter is like the crackling of thorns. And he said, I commend mirth. What is he saying? He's saying that if you think having a big party is what life's all about, you're going to be wretched and miserable. But if you understand serving God is what life's all about, there'll be a lot of time for the laughter, genuine and true laughter, and joy can come into your life. It's the gift of God, is it not? The perspective is what changes everything. Then chapter 9, verses 7 to 10. I love these verses. Go your way, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart. I judge he's just talking about good food. And yet Solomon, when he tried to make it what life is all about, found it a bitter emptiness and futility. But now when God is in the picture, and we are understanding that it's God who gives us these things, they come with joy. For God hath already accepted your works. Let your garments be always white, and let not your head lack oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your life of vanity, which he hath given you under the sun, all the days of vanity, for that is your portion in life, and in your labor wherein you labor under the sun. Good advice. How much we live in tomorrow, which has not come. I say we live in tomorrow, we hope to live. As a friend of mine used to say, we don't live, we hope to live. Today is nothing. And I think Solomon is saying, you have something today in your hand. You have food, you have a family, and you ought to rejoice and be glad in it. Live joyfully with a wife whom you love all the days of your life of vanity. It's a life of vanity in the sense that it's cut off. And we know that. It's not going to always be. And I said to myself, as I thought about my own situation, and I have said, one of these days we're going to do this. I've said that so many times, my wife says, yes, 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 yes. And I told her, I know she doesn't believe me when I say these things. But we need to seize the day. There's some here who can tell you that's right. But the reason we can seize the day with joy and not with panic is because it's not going to be taken away from us forever. But you ought to live joyfully with your husband and with your wife and with your children, the days that God gives. You don't know what the future will hold. Tragedy can come. Things that you never imagined can transpire. But as you have them, trusting God, use them joyfully and thankfully. That, I think, is the counsel of Solomon here. But how shall we deal with this oscillating prosperity and adversity? Back and forth, back and forth. Chapter 7, verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider. When things are going well, don't sit around and say, yes, I know, but it can change in a minute. Who knows what's going to happen? Don't say that. And when adversity comes, let it sober you. Don't despise the chastening of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. Do you know who wrote that? Solomon. And it's recorded by the writer of Hebrews, chapter 12. So, we receive these things knowing, as Romans 8, verse 18 says, that the sufferings of the present time are not worthy to be compared to the glory that shall be revealed to us. And as Paul says in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 17, our light affliction, which is for the moment, works for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory. I don't always understand. No, I seldom understand why things are the way they are. But I know whose hand is guiding it. And I need to thank God in the days when things are going well. And I need to trust Him in the days of adversity. And out of all that, in His great eternal genius, He will do, as our brother Sewell has been telling us, He will conform us to the image of His Son, which is marvelous enough to think about, that we should be like Him. But that is the promise and purpose of God. And so I think that what Solomon says is true, and the lessons of his great book are wisely to be considered and have been spoken in other places in the Scripture as well. Thank you.